With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Welcome to DSC's Campfires with Larry Wysoon. The unique blend of hunting, conservation, and the outdoor lifestyle delivered in an entertaining, informative fashion that only a veteran outdoorsman can do. DSC Campfires is brought to you by DSC, the Dallas Safari Club, Conservation, Education, and Hunter Advocacy, Hornady, Accurate, Deadly, Dependable, Trigicon, Brilliant Aiming Solutions, Ruger, Rugged, Reliable Firearms, Burnham Brothers Game Calls, The Callingest Call Made, Double Nickel Taxidermy, where hunting memories are preserved. Now here's your host, Larry Wysoon.
Last week, we had the opportunity to talk a little bit about mule deer hunting and some of the mule deer hunts that I've been on in the past. Talked some about the first mule deer you shot. And it's that time of the year where you really need to start thinking about mule deer if you're going to try to hunt mule deer this year. You know, when I started hunting mule deer, oh my gosh, a very long time ago, there weren't such things as drawings or limited entry or any of those other kind of things. We had tremendous mule deer populations. People hunted kind of where they wanted to. And if today you wanted to go hunting mule deer and the mule deer season started in 3 days, you simply drove to the state that you wanted to hunt and bought a license across the counter and went out and hunted public land or possibly even a little bit of private land. And there was a good mule deer population. Well, over the years, things have changed. Human populations have increased dramatically. A lot of what used to be mule deer habitat now is human habitation. A lot of the corridors through which deer migrated, and the thing about Rocky Mountain mule deer is they have a tendency to have a kind of a summer-fall range and then a winter range. And during the summertime, they're up in the mountains and where there's a lot of food and all those kind of things. And I kind of messed that up a little bit there. But during summer, they were in the mountains. Now, when the snows came and the ice came and started driving those deer out of the mountains, they had to go somewhere where there was something to eat. I remember years ago, I took care of a ranch in the very northwest corner of Colorado where the Yampa and the Little Snake River come together, essentially, just right there on the Wyoming-Utah border. At the right time, when the snows got really bad in the northern part or just north of us up in the mountains of Wyoming and parts of Utah, those deer would come through there, those being migratory mule deer. I'd see as many as maybe as 3 or 4 come through in a little group, and then you'd see 10 or 15 and then 20. And occasionally you'd see a herd of maybe as many as 50, 60 or more, even up to 100 sometimes come through that ranch going to the lower country down in the Dinosaur National Monument area where there was plenty of food for them and they could make the winter. And once the winter was over with, then they'd start drifting back up into the higher country and spend the summer time there, late spring, summer, early fall maybe, and then as soon as the winters came, here they came again. So what's happened in a lot of those areas where previously we've had migratory mule deer, the corridor, if you will, has been blocked to some extent by housing developments, by fences, by so many different things. And one of the things that's happened over the years is thankfully through organizations like the Mule Deer Foundation, they have gone in some instances they've bought some of the property, they've leased some of the property, they have built overpasses and underpasses across highways that allow these deer to cross without being a traffic problem. And things are really starting to turn around a little bit. I recently had the opportunity to visit a little bit with Greg Sammons. Now, Greg, we've talked a lot about in the past, and I've had him on the show, and will again in the future. Greg, this past year, a couple years ago, in 2019, shot a West Texas mule deer, the crook eye species that we've talked about, that he called Hank, of all names. And that deer grossed over 300 and netted like 292 and some change, making it the biggest desert mule deer, highest scoring, I guess I should say, desert mule deer ever recorded. And I was asking him, I said, Greg, that property that you manage, and I had actually shot my first mule deer almost within sight of where Greg shot his, this big buck. And I said, what are the three or four major things that you do on that property? And it was interesting because a lot of what he suggested is things that I've done on the same ranches that I've dealt with over the years for mule deer. And one of the things that he mentioned was grazing pressure. So many places we've overgrazed with livestock, and that could be, in some instances, out in that western part of the country for a while, it was wild horses. Those wild horses and burros, they would take over water holes, which is another important factor in mule deer and other wildlife species out there. But they take over the water holes, and the thing about the horses and donkeys is they have teeth on the top and bottom, so they reach all the way to the bottom of that plant, and when they eat, they may pull the entire plant out, whereas like cattle or goats or sheep, they have only teeth on the lower side, insides, or in the front. And so they have a little bit more of a difficult time to really grub those plants out like horses do. But so horses, cattle, sheep, goats, all those, if they're overgrazed, if they're overutilized that range, it takes away the primary species that are there. And as a result of that, there's a lack of food. So grazing pressure can be really good too, because the hoof action, it can stir up the soil. Grazing from livestock or years ago with buffalo, what would happen when there were buffalo in that country, the buffalo would come through, eat everything down, they'd leave. And all these little things could come up, and green grass and green forbs and or weeds, if you will, those would be coming up kind of after the buffalo went through. So it was kind of a rotational grazing system that the buffalo did, and the other species such as elk and mule deer and pronghorn and those others kind of followed a lag time behind once that vegetation started coming back up again. Well, basically, that you can do the same thing with livestock. If you're going to have cattle or on property, the best thing to do is to set up a rotational grazing system where you have got an area that's been grazed, you pull the cattle off, things start coming back, and you just kind of rotate around it over a series of pastures. And by doing so, there's always some stage of good growth there for not only the cattle, but also for the livestock that's there. So grazing can be so very important in a positive manner, and if it's overdone, in a negative manner. Water. I mentioned water a while ago. One of the things that happened when we had a lot of wild horses out there in some of that western country that I used to take care of in Colorado is that they would just take over a water hole and chase everything else away. So that was a problem just in itself. But one of the things that we did on the ranches that I dealt with out there for mule deer is we would, we were private land, thankfully, and we were surrounded by a bunch of public land. Now, on the public land, there really wasn't a whole lot we could do, but on the private land, we could put in water holes, and we did. We put up a whole bunch of little ponds, little tanks, and there are several ways of doing that in that some of that soil is pretty porous, so that means that you get water, it's there for a short period of time, and then it just kind of absorbs into the ground. Well, there were two ways that we did to try to seal those tanks, and we dispersed these throughout or set them up throughout the property so where that deer never really had to move more than about maybe a mile between water holes. Now, we did have water troughs at wells, too, and we'll get back to that. But with these, what we'd do is we'd dig these little tanks, little deep holes, and kind of slope them to so that the animals could walk to the water, so that it wasn't just a deep, like a pan kind of thing or a pot. So we would dig those, and then where we could, we would use bentonite, which is a lot of people refer to as drilling mud, but we would put bentonite in the bottom of these, and that would kind of seal those ponds. The other thing that we did on some of the shallower type ponds that we built is we would use stock salt, just rock salt, if you will, and what happens there is that country where we were, there wasn't a whole lot of salt in that country, so salt was kind of an attractant to the local cattle, the local deer, elk, whatever was there, and they would come in there and they would kind of lick on that salt, and in the process of that, they would also leave their droppings there. And over a period of time, you would form kind of a natural seal on the bottom of this where it would eventually become water holes. And so those two worked really well. Now, both of them took a period of time. So when we did them, we looked at maybe 5 years from now is we're going to have water there. The other thing is we talked about water troughs. And one of the things that we did, we were fortunate. We had some water in a lot of that country. It comes at a very premium. It's very deep, and then sometimes it's got a lot of minerals and things in it. But so what we did is we would set up water tanks, meaning storage tanks, and from those storage tanks we would pump those up and then gravity feed, just by gravity pulling down to water troughs with floats on them that control the water level. But one of the things I did beyond that too is I always made sure that there was a small depression somewhere very close to those watering facilities for livestock, because I noticed over the years that for whatever reason there may be clear water in a water trough, but if there's a little mud hole about 10 or 15 steps away from that clear water, that's where the wildlife is going to water. That's where they go for water. I guess it's because it's much more of a natural situation for them. So we always had little overflow ponds as well, too. And those, a lot of times, I would fence with barbed wire so to keep the cattle out of those areas to where they were specifically watering areas for wildlife. That worked really well, too. And one of the things I did there as well is if I didn't have that opportunity to have those low water troughs to where even a fawn could come up and drink out of it, what I'd do for birds is that if you had a water trough and it's kind of built like a pot, and say the water level is an inch below that pot, well, in a real world situation, it may be, you know, 6-8 inches from a steep sided trough to where the water is. So birds can't really water in those kind of situations. They can't get the water, and if they do, they're probably going to fall in and drown. So what I would do is I'd take a 2x12 piece of wood, and I'd cut it in chunks about maybe, depending on the size of the water trough, anywhere from 12 to maybe 18 inches long. To the bottom of that, I would put a nail, and on the bottom side of a board, I'd put a nail, put a chain or wire, and I would attach that to an anchor. And my anchors were generally 1 to 2 pound coffee cans that I'd filled with concrete and put a little hook in there where I could hook a chain from that floating structure, if you will, that piece of wood to the bottom, so they wouldn't float all over the place. That allowed those birds to light upon that platform and drink. And tell you what, it made a lot of difference, particularly in those areas where we were concerned about setting up or could not set up the little overflow type ponds. Now, some of the western areas that I've dealt with in Texas and New Mexico, we built what we call guzzlers. And basically what a guzzler is a metal platform. We've used all kinds of different types of tins and all that kind of thing. And so you create almost like a roof, and not quite sloped as much as what a roof is. And then you have a central gathering point, kind of where you put gutters on the sides to where all the water that hits on that platform, if you will, runs into a gutter, which goes into a storage tank, which goes into an area from there to where animals can water, a little low on the ground type of water troughs. So every time that it rains, guess what? Rain hits the platform, if you will, or the tin, runs off. And so you can gather a lot of moisture that way, and with it set up properly with a little float to where an animal or nothing else can get to it, you can have water for a long period of time. Sometimes too, just the dew that forms on these, and when you have temperature changes, there's enough there to where you get a little bit of a runoff to where it goes in the storage tank. We've used these quite extensively, and as I said, in western part of the state of Texas, but also elsewhere, and down in Mexico, where there's really not a whole lot of subsurface moisture or water. So you're depending upon whatever rainfall there is so that you've got drinking water for the animals. But these have worked really, really well, and organizations like Mule Deer Foundation has been very instrumental in helping with these, and the DSC Foundation, the Dallas Fire Club Foundation, has funded numerous of these projects, like down in Mexico and western Texas, and they're used extensively in parts of New Mexico and Arizona, and those guzzlers have done extremely well as far as providing moisture or water for animals. And the beauty of it is you can set them up almost anywhere. So you can scatter them across the country, depending on what the populations are. You can have them, you know, relatively close if there's lots of them, or you can have them great distance, talking about lots of animals, or scatter them quite a distance apart to where there's not a whole lot of animals in that area, but you're dispersing them over a larger area that way as well, too, rather than concentrating all those animals to one water hole, which kind of, in a big area, when you do that sometimes, you know, if it's like setting up a grocery store. If you set up a grocery store in an area, and guess where the predators, in those instances, maybe we're predators on the grocery stores, if you want to look at it that way. That's where the predators congregate. And so you want to set these up over a larger area, and that brings up predators. The third thing that we did on the ranches that I've dealt with, and same thing with envisioning with Greg Simons, who I have great respect for as a wildlife biologist, but also as a mule deer hunter and somebody who really cares about wildlife, is one of the things Greg has done in a lot of the ranches that he has managed, particularly for mule deer, is to control predators. Now, that does not mean the annihilation of predators, because I don't think you could do that anyway. If you set up the idea that I am going to get rid of every coyote, every bobcat, every mountain lion, it would not happen, because those animals learn how to adapt to those kind of pressures very quickly, and they avoid traps, they avoid coming to calls, and all those other kind of things. But predator control can be very, very important, particularly in those areas when you have a relatively hard drought going into the fawning season, if you will. If there's a lot of vegetation on the ground, it's a little bit harder for those coyotes and bobcats to see those fawns. And so what we try to do on so many different ranches, and as this is being recorded, I'm getting ready to go on a predator hunt with Gary Robertson, who with Burnham Brothers calls with their rogue call that he came up with, that we'll visit a little bit here in the next couple of weeks, because we're going to try to set up some of the podcast as if we are in the field, which we're actually going to be. But one of the ranches that I deal with that I get to hunt is the Hargrove Ranch. It's called as far as internet type stuff, you want to learn more about it, it's called Hargrove Hunts. HARGROVEHUNTS.com. And I think that's the Facebook as well, too. And you can learn more about it. They have both whitetail and mule deer. And really, we're trying to increase the mule deer population in that area. This is an area kind of south of Lubbock in the lower edge of the Texas Panhandle. But we're going to be out there trying to call coyotes this next week, and trying to reduce that coyote population before the fawns start hitting the ground, and that means before they're being born. So predator control to me is extremely important two times of the year, in that when the fawns, right before the fawns are being born, and then too in late winter when A lot of times, if you get a buck, particularly a mature buck, it's run a lot, he's chased a lot, he gets run down. Those coyotes are serious predators on those kind of deer, and you want to give them the opportunity to get back on their feet again, because they may be the ones that you're looking for. And in any kind of herd, whether it's hunted or not, you want a good distribution of young bucks, medium age bucks, and old age bucks. And to do that, predator control becomes an important thing as well too. Now, one of the things that we have in mule deer herds or mule deer habitat in Texas and New Mexico, and I suspect maybe even, I know in parts of Mexico as well too, is we have feral hogs. Now, there's no doubt that feral hogs, particularly those that weigh, say, 120 pounds or even larger, that they will eat fawns. Quite frankly, they will. We did some work many years ago, I did, where I shot 20 big hogs out of a helicopter. This is when we first started doing helicopter things like that. And 18 out of the 20 hogs that I shot had remains of whitetail fawns in them. So it tells me where you've got a high population of wild hogs, they're probably predators on fawns. And in West Texas or in mule deer habitat, desert mule deer habitat, where those hogs exist, yes, if there's an opportunity for them to find a mule deer fawn, of course, they're going to kill it and eat it. They're very much opportunists, kind of like coyotes are. So all that kind of complicates. So when I start talking about predator control on some of the ranches that I deal with, not in the Rocky Mountains so much, but particularly from the desert variety of mule deer, the control of feral hogs is a part of that predator control too. We talked a little bit about things eating hogs eating deer rather, and some of the things that eat the fawns, but let's talk a little bit more about hunting. To me, as I've said before, there's hardly anything that I can think of that's more impressive than a really big mule deer buck. And I'm talking about a buck that's approaching that 30 inches wide or wider, and he's almost as tall as he is wide, and he's real massive. His antlers are as thick around as what his ears butts are, and because when he turns his head standing on a ridge, to me it's not like he's turning his head, it's like the world revolves down below him. When I was a little bitty kid, my uncles, or not so much my uncles, a couple of my uncles, but a lot of my cousins hunted Colorado, and my first sight of a mule deer was on the back of a pickup that my dad's first cousin, Crockett Linebacker, brought by the house to show us. And I remember that deer being way outside of his ears and tall, and I mean, I was just absolutely, totally impressed, enthralled, and all those things by the sight of that deer. And at the time, I was about 6 years old, and I resolved that, you know, one of these days, I'm going to go hunt mule deer. It took a while to do that, but thankfully, I was able to hunt mule deer and been able to hunt them several different places, and have a few more places I'd really like to return to go hunt them. When it comes to firearms, I've hunted them with, not so much with bows. I've hunted them with a bow a little bit years and years ago. But remember, I think I may have told you that when I'm asked about, you know, about being a bow hunter, my response generally is, yeah, I'm bow hunting. And then I grew up. Well, actually, I shot my last deer with a bow in 1984. So that's quite a few years ago. But I hunted them a little bit with a bow years ago, and also hunted them with rifles, muzzleloaders, and handguns. The best desert mule deer I ever shot, I shot with my Ruger Super Blackhawk Hunter 44 mag with a 240 grain XTP Hornady ammo, which that particular 44 mag absolutely loves. At 100 yards, it'll keep all six shots, in a little over an inch group if I do my part. If I kind of slip around a little bit and don't do everything, it's still at 100 yards going to shoot less than about a 4-inch group, which is pretty darn good when you get right down to it. It just simply means that if I'm going to hunt mule deer with it, I need to be within 100 yards or so of one. And that's always my intention anyway, is try to get as close as I can. But over the years, I've shot them with a muzzleloader. I used to do a fair amount of hunting with a night rifle with an MK-85, or versions of it, with Tony Knight and Jim Zumbo. And then for years, too, I did the PR work for Thompson Center Arms. And as a result of that, shot and hunted with the TC Encore and two or three of the other muzzleloaders that we had. But those are always fun. And again, my shots, I limited myself to about 100, 125 yards, even though I knew I could make a shot longer than that. But that was just kind of my self-imposed limit. Shot my first mule deer, I think I told you last time, with a 300 Savage. Now, at the time of that hunt, my gun that I had was a 30-30 Winchester, and even though there have been tons and tons of deer and probably elk kill with a 30-30 Winchester, I really felt like I needed something with a little bit more oomph, if you will. Well, as it worked out, my brother had bought a gun that was a Savage Model 99 lever action, 300 Savage, had a K4 Weber scope on it, and I borrowed it for that first hunt to shoot my first mule deer with. And over the years, I have shot them with lots of different calibers. A lot of them with a 270, a lot of them with a 30-06, a lot with the 300 Win Mag, with the old 405 Winchester. Shot one with a 405 Winchester out in West Texas several years ago. I shot several out there because Texas had just started the managed land program, and one of the things that we were able to do is to take more than one mule deer on special permits. And so I was able to take some deer with that, and like Farcorns, and that were really old, and ended up shooting a really nice buck one of those years that I hunted out there on that particular ranch with that 405 Winchester in a single shot at about 200 yards. Now, I had shot that gun a fair amount, and I knew where it hit at different ranges, so that's what made the difference. And I couldn't get any closer. That was the problem. I love to get as close as I can, regardless of what I'm shooting. And in that instance, I shot that 405 with a 300 grain saw point from Hornady, that I knew exactly where that thing hit. I'd actually shot it out to 500 yards as well, too, just kind of on a whim to see where I could, or what I could do at 500 yards. And surprisingly, that particular gun shot reasonably well at 500. Now, would I have shot a deer at that distance? No way. I didn't feel like I had sufficient downrange energy to really do any good at that distance. But you know, if it came down to a favorite round, and a few years ago, Ruger came out with a 280 Ackley Improved as kind of a called the Joe Clayton, kind of Joe Clayton special. Joe Clayton really kind of started collecting Ruger number ones years ago, and he was one of the first guys. And so to honor him, they did this. Lee Newton, who's a dear friend and a collector of Ruger number ones and does a lot of work with Ruger number ones, suggested they do this Joe Clayton special in a 280 Ackley Improved, which is Joe's favorite caliber. So in the process of honoring Joe, they also found some unbelievably beautiful wood. Well, I was able to get like the third or fourth one of those out of a pick out of the whole bunch. Actually, it was Joe Clayton and Lee Newton that picked out this particular gun for me. And so I thought, you know what, that'd be the ideal one to use. And I ended up doing a story about it for the Gun Digest, 2020 Gun Digest, or 21 maybe. And absolutely gorgeous wood, but used a Hornady load in that one. And hunting with Greg Simons on this property where he shot Hank, I was there to shoot a management buck, and finally able to put a really nice, ancient old buck down. He was massive, probably only about a 15-inch spread or so, but he'd seen his better days and was on his way down, and it was the appropriate thing to do, is to take him and so I kind of honored him, I guess, by taking him and writing stories about it, and putting his antlers on the wall. Of course, mule deer venison particularly if they're eating good stuff. Now, if they're on strictly one plant and don't have a whole lot of other, they can be a little bit rank at times or during the rut, but this particular old buck had not been chasing any at all, I don't think. He was beyond that stage, so the meat was sweet and tender and quite the opposite of what you might think off of a really big old buck like that, but nonetheless, he was extremely good to eat. Hunting with a .30-06 and a .270 down in Mexico, down in Sonora, those burrow deer down there have a tendency to turn into beautiful animals. They have a fair amount of mass, the antlers do, and with a lot of widespread. And these days, probably if you're looking for an opportunity to hunt really big mule deer, where you don't have to go through possibly years and years of getting preference points and being drawn to hunt particular areas, Sonora is probably the best place to go to. Now, there are two different types of hunts down in Sonora, in that they've started some breeding programs down there, and a lot of times they'll have a breeding herd, and then they'll release those animals into a huge enclosure, if you will, or just into open range, and then they're the open range hunts as well, too. The ones that I've been able to hunt down there have been on the open range, and even though I've seen some really outstanding deer, I hunted down there one year with Tri-State Outfitters, with what used to be run by Richard Petrini, now it's run by Bridger Petrini, his son. It's Tri-State Outfitters, and Bridger set up a hunt for me down there with an old dear friend of his who was one of the trackers years ago. They would, for any mule deer in Sonora, they would get on a track and follow that track until they found that deer, and then you'd make a decision as to whether or not you wanted to shoot him or not. Well, I got to hunt with one of these trackers, and we did. We would find a track, and we would get on a track. And unfortunately, hunting that method, everyone that we were able to get onto was just a nice deer, not what that area is known for. But while I was there, I saw three outstanding deer. All three of them, no doubt in my mind, were well over 200. Two of them were non-typicals, and one of them was a huge, huge typical, the biggest typical I've ever seen. But in the process of all that, toward the end of the hunt, I ended up taking a really nice mule deer, probably about 28 inches wide, with decent mass. If you're into scoring, he was probably one of those ones, probably 180 class deer, but just absolutely a gorgeous deer, which I am truly, truly proud of. Would I'd like to have shot one of those 200s? Well, of course I would have. That's still one of my goals, to shoot a really, what I consider a really big mule deer. Seen a few of them. I've seen them down in Mexico. I've seen them in Colorado. I've seen them in New Mexico. Oh my gosh, I mean, there's some of those deer, just even thinking about them just almost brings chills to me about the size that they were. Years ago, I was hunting in northern New Mexico around San Antonio Mountain. We were there, I was there as a guest of the New Mexico Game Department. I used to help them out on some projects every once in a while, and when I worked for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, in return, they would put me on a hunt somewhere where we were up on a ridge hunting elk, as it worked. It was a late season elk hunt, and I'd seen some elk drop into a brushy draw, and I kind of eased up on the ridge, kind of looked down into that brushy draw, and when I did, I said, oh my God, it was so brushy. And I jumped this animal, and he was moving through the brush. Really, all I could see was the tips of his antlers through all this brush. And I got shooting 270, and I got on. I was just following the movement, kind of like if you've seen cartoons or whatever, where, or maybe you've seen it in real life, where there's really tall grass and you can see the grass kind of move, and you know there's something underneath there. And well, that's the way this was, but I could see the antler tips, and I'm following this animal, and just as it steps out, I am anticipating it to be just a nice elk, you know, a really nice 6x6. Probably about 35, 40 inches wide, and you know, just the tips of his antlers that I've seen, and I'm following it through the scope, and this animal comes out on the other side and almost pulled the trigger, and then I realized it wasn't an elk. It was a mule deer. This mule deer was probably 38 inches outside from the, and I'm talking about the tips of his back tines, or and top tines that I could see, and He had unbelievable mass. He had a drop tine on the right side, and he stopped, walked out in the open, turned around and looked at me, and I'm going, oh my gracious, I cannot believe this. If only it were mule deer season instead of elk. Why didn't they put me on a mule deer hunt instead of an elk hunt? The mule deer season obviously was closed, and I watched this deer walk away, and even today I'll be somewhere and I'll start thinking about mule deer. That one comes to mind. There's another one that comes to mind too. And this one's down in Mexico. I mentioned seeing one of the largest mule deer I've ever seen. It probably is largest typical. I was down there hunting coos deer and on Jesus Fimbres' place, Rancho Grande. And Jesus has got a lot of mule on his property, and he had about a 200-acre irrigated field that where every night mule deer would come in, or all day they'd probably stay there, but every night the mule deer would come in there to feed. We drove to the far back side of his property, and no sooner we did, we saw a mule deer that was just by far the biggest, most impressive typical I've ever seen. And we followed this deer, was moving toward the field, and so we were just kind of zigzagging in the vehicle across pastures, and we saw this deer numerous times, and so we got some really good looks at this deer. So I know pretty close to what he was, but this deer was a typical 5x5, including brow tines, not a kicker, not anything else, just as slick as they can be. The antlers were bigger around pretty much all the way throughout the rack, as bigger around and bigger than the ear base, which is about probably 7 inches or so. And spread wise, he was as probably 40 inches outside. He was as wide, his antlers were as wide as essentially his body was long from his shoulders to his backside. So he was well over 36, 38, maybe even that 40 inches. His front tines were longer than he was through the depth of his body from the brisket to the withers. His back tines were nearly twice that long, and they split about 5-6 inches, maybe 8 inches off of where they came off the main beam. He had brow tines unlike any mule deer I've ever seen. In brow tines, yearly mule deer generally don't have real long brow tines, or most of them don't. Occasionally you'll see one that's got, 3-inch brow tines, but these brow tines were probably 5-6 inches long, almost as long as the inside of his ear. So that would be about 6-7 inches. Usually in looking at mass, one of the first things I do is I compare the circumference or the diameter, if you will, of the main beam and of the points to the eye. Mule deer and whitetail both have their eye, and if you did a circumference of it, is about four inches, maybe a little bit bigger in some, maybe a little bit smaller in others, but it's about an inch across, and so that makes it about, I've measured a lot of them, and they're usually run right at 4 inches. Well, the mass on this buck, the tips were as big around as what this deer was, and his eyes were. I mean, he was just a phenomenal deer. That deer came into that field. We watched him in that field that afternoon just a little bit, and he had a mule deer hunter coming in the next day, and so we got back to camp, and he was supposed to come in that night. Of course, they went out and looked for this deer for the next 8 days and never again saw him. Evidently, he was just one of those deer that was passing through, or he was a local deer that was just super, super secretive. I'm not sure which the case was. I do know if I'd had a gun and it'd been okay with Jesus, I would have been pulling the trigger on this deer, because I've never seen the likes of him, even in looking at some of the really big mule deer racks. Years ago, a dear friend of mine who's since passed away, Homer Say, collected mule deer antlers. And a lot of those ended up being put into various museums. But if you're ever through the have an opportunity to stop at the Cabela's store in Kansas City, go back into the back where they've got the the dioramas and all those kind of set up, and there you will find the biggest mule deer in the world, the biggest collection of big mule deer antlers. And most of those at one time Homer had collected, and almost every one of those racks I've in the years past when he was collecting those, I got a chance to hold in my hand, which is how I can finally and actually see what antlers look like. I tell people, they'll tell me about a particularly big antler or set of antlers, and I go, oh, that's really nice. But until I can really put my hands on them and feel them to where I can see in actuality how wide they are, how massive they are, how tall they are, the number of points they have, all those kind of things. I tell people, well, I've not really ever seen them until I get a chance to do that. But please, if you ever get a chance to do that, go through Kansas City and go by the Cabela store. And I think you'll be unbelievably impressed if you like mule deer. I've never seen the likes of a collection that even comes close to that. Occasionally, they would pull and make replicas of some of those antlers, and you'd see them in some of the other Cabela's, now Bass Pro stores as well, too. But not as a whole, as a collection, there will you ever see anything even close to those things, even some of the traveling things that go on and about. But I said, there's nothing more impressive than a big mule deer. To me, they're probably the premier game animal in North America. There's so, even where there's a lot of big mule deer, there's so very few of them. And these days, they have, for whatever reason, through predators, through habitat, through, you know, the mule deer's kind of taking it on the chin a little bit. And thankfully, the Mule Deer Foundation is making inroads through some of the things that they're doing to counteract a lot of this. But at a time many years ago, there was a time in Colorado when you could take 3 mule deer. I had cousins that hunted up there during that time frame, so I know that to be the case. And the mule deer that they shot were all bigger, much bigger than by far the average mule deer that you find today. And hopefully one of these days we can get back to that situation, and maybe at least in a small way. But these days, as I mentioned too, if you want to try to take a really big mule deer, you better start applying for it about 10 to 15 years for that permit before you think you might be able to hunt them. You might get lucky and draw a permit early, but the chance of those premium tags that they have available these days of drawing those, unless you've been involved in the drawing system for years, are pretty close to nil and none. There are some private land permits that are sold every year in some of the states that have become fairly expensive. But if you save up the money and all that kind of thing, they can be bought. And there are also things like governor's tags, commissioner's tags that are issued every year. You know, the best place to do that is to try to get in touch with the Mule Deer Foundation and find out what the Western Expo, when that's going to be, and they'll have an auction there. And of course, that's a great place to find outfitters that outfit for mule deer. And of course, DSC Convention is another one of those places that we have every year in January. My gosh, we'll have some really outstanding mule deer show up there as well in different people's booths and that outfit from Mexico all the way up into Canada. There's some areas in Canada that are still producing some really nice mule deer. The area that I hunt with Ron Nemechek with North River Outfitting for whitetails, they're kind of north, and I guess that's a little bit west of Edmonton. There used to be some really big mule deer in that country. And the last times I've been up there, if you see a four-corn mule deer, or, and I'm talking about maybe a 3x3 that's not all that fantastic, but just kind of a nice deer, that's a really big deer for that area now. But there are some mule deer in Alberta that are extremely big, just to the south, kind of in that lower part of the province. The future of the mule deer is tough to say, but with, as I said, the efforts of hunters, conservation groups like DSC and DSC Foundation, of course, the Mule Deer Foundation, we're making some inroads to bring the mule deer and keep the mule deer where he is and bring the mule deer back. And I think that's kind of where we need to look at is what can we do to bring the mule deer back? And you know, we've lost habitat. We're going to continue losing habitat for mule deer and those kind of areas, particularly in the west, the northern part, you know, kind of the Rocky Mountains. The Rocky Mountains have kind of become a place where everybody wants to go to. And we're dealing with states now that don't understand the necessity of proper management of habitat, proper management of the species. Hopefully we can change some of that, and hopefully we can change some of the policies regarding wolf introductions and those sort of things. We're finding out that wolves and black bear and grizzlies and coyotes and bobcats and those things, we've known for years that they do eat mule deer, and they eat mule deer fawns, and they eat grown mule deer. And in those areas where we have an increased population of mountain lions, which are increasing across the western landscape and even moving into the east, and now they're showing up a whole lot more down the southeast as well, too. What happens in those western states where you have mule deer, where you also have a whole lot of coyotes a lot of times, a lion will make a kill, and usually that lion would have eaten off that kill for, say, maybe a week. And before it went out and started looking for another one. Well, now with the increased coyote population, what happens is lion makes a kill, gets one meal off of it, and guess what? Coyotes move in, they eat it up, lion's got to go make another kill, so we're compounding the situation. Again, that's one of the reasons that some of these areas where we really need to control the coyote population and really to do something with the mountain lion population as well, too. And some areas, even black bear are becoming a potential or are a predator on mule deer fawns in particular. So need to look at all those things and try to take a common sense approach. Do we want to get rid of all the predators? No, heavens no. Predators have a place, and we need predators. Do we need as many predators as we have? Nope, we really don't. We need to manage them like we would and should manage the other species that we have available out there that are part of the landscape, that are part of that environment and part of that ecosystem. So, but we need to take a common sense approach to all those kind of things and realize that hunting plays such a great important part in these type of things, because hunters are the ones who are paying for the conservation. And I know some people go, oh yeah, sure they do, but over the years, as a wildlife biologist who's worked on a lot of different properties, including properties for mule deer, what we've seen is, as we've improved the habitat for mule deer, guess what? Songbirds, all the little mammals, game birds, all the different things, and particularly the plant species themselves, so greatly benefit from a hunting program or a program where hunting is involved as far as the management program is concerned. We don't need to be preservationist. And if you try to preserve something, that doesn't really accomplish a whole lot. We need to be conservationist, which means a conservationist simply means the wise use of, and the wise use of based on scientific data rather than emotions that so often people get caught up in. The wildlife in a state does not need, it needs to be managed for the benefit of the people that live there, but it needs to be managed based upon sound wildlife management principles. And again, hunting plays very important to that. It doesn't need to be maintained or doesn't need to be managed by policies set by the public, who has really no idea. In some instances, not everybody is that way, but there's certainly a fair number of people out there that deal with emotions rather than real life. And to manage mule deer properly, and for managing mule deer properly means to have hunting, as I mentioned, to put an economic benefit on these so that we can use that as a means of keeping that population there and expanding the habitat where we can, or improving the habitat. Habitat for wildlife in particular, mule deer, seems to be shrinking. So that means we have to more intensively manage that habitat that remains, and to try to figure out how to ways we can connect these little pockets of habitat, if you will. In the future, we're going to talk about a lot of different things. As I mentioned, I'm getting ready to go on a predator hunt and maybe a little bit of a turkey hunt. I'm meeting with this coming week with Gary Robertson with Burnham Brothers Game Calls, his son Steve, and we're going to film some things for Corn of War TV. And then I'm also meeting with Dave Fulson with Safari Classics with his cameraman, Cameron Kuncher. And we're filming some segments for Trigicon's World of Sports and Field, which is a TV show I've started doing some shows for, and you'll start really seeing those crop up this year. I did a mule deer hunt for them and got a bunch of other hunts planned for them this coming year. Two, I want to invite you. I finally set up a YouTube channel. It took me forever, but it's Larry Wysoon Outdoors, and it's just getting started. I'm going to post a lot of different things here, including possibly some podcast things as well, but some of the shows that I do with Luke Clayton and Jeff Rice are going to appear there, Sportsman's Life, and I'm going to try to pull some of the old shows that I did from years ago. And beyond that, I'm taking my camera and I'm filming a lot of short segments of involving hunts, doing tips, and those kind of things, and things that I've learned over the year about, or the years, I guess I should say, not this year, but things that I've learned over the years. So I would ask that if you into those kind of things, that you please have a look at my YouTube channel. Again, that's Larry Wysoon Outdoors. It's the same as my Instagram handle, and you can get in touch with me there, and also at Facebook at Larry Wysoon Outdoors, and let me know some of the things that you'd like to hear about and maybe even write about. I'm still doing a lot of writing. So, you know, please try to get in touch with me, and I'll do my best where I can to respond in as quickly a manner as I can on a personal basis. But also, I'll take certainly in consideration and try to do those things that you out there, our listeners and our viewers and our readers, would like to hear about. So, got to go pack up, got to go load up a couple of Ruger rifles, and there are several Ruger rifles and handguns and a whole bunch of Horny ammo, and I've got a new Trigicon scope that I'm going to mount on a 280 Ackley improved bolt action rifle that I just got, a Ruger 7.7, and a couple of other guns that I'm getting ready to take out there with me to hunt hogs, to hunt coyotes, and all those other kind of good things. So truly look forward to you joining me right here on DSC's Campfires with Larry Wysoon here next week and the following weeks as well. We'll see you next week. Thank you for joining us today.
DSC's Campfires with Larry Wysoon has also been brought to you by Texas Wildlife Association, working for tomorrow's wildlife today. Texas-raised hunting products, the Scent Gods, Kinetrek boots for the trails less traveled. Voigt, the finest in hunting gear. Pyramid Air for all things air gun. And Ripcord Rescue Travel Protection.